gonna go see Morbius for the purposes of this podcast so we can have a little laugh.
Okay.
I really couldn't bring myself to it. And I watched something else instead. Oh. So
I don't blame you. I mean, like,
watching Jared Leto in a superhero flick is just not my idea of a good time, especially considering how many new movies there are out there right now.
Yes.
And just the fact that it tried, I think, haphazardly to tie into the MCU somehow.
Yeah.
And I was already kind of turned off by the whole Eddie Brock post-credit sequence in No Way Home.
Right.
And if they try to just like really mix the Sony universe with the Marvel universe, I wouldn't be able to handle it.
Yeah, because you know that like there's some sort of multiverse thing that would probably be brought up at some point. And
that was kind of the thing with No Way Home, is that somehow Marvel folded in the Sony IP with like extreme seamlessness. Like it really seemed like they were all part of the same universe. But now they're trying to do it with all these, you know, side and secondary characters, and it just doesn't make any sense. The convoluted reason, lengthy explanation why I didn't see Morbius, although I will see it at some point when it's out on streaming, because I have to see this train wreck. There are a lot of movies out there that are better and I think worth more our time and money.
Yeah.
And so one of the things I thought we were going to talk about is Everything Everywhere All at Once.
Yes, that's going to be, I think that'll be like the main thing for this episode.
That'll be an interesting conversation because I'm back to my old ways. I'm going against the grain.
Oh, no. Oh, man, he's pulling this on me now. Okay.
This is going to be a long cold open for you, but that's okay.
No, I'll just chop like 2/3 of it. Or
no, you quarters. Know what? This is fitting because we don't see the opening credits for Everything Everywhere All at Once until like what, half an hour into the movie?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
There's some meta for you right there.
Yeah, so we might as well have the cold open reflect the first movie out of the gate. So on that note, do you want to get started?
Yes, let's do it.
Welcome to the Extra Buttery Podcast. It's a show about movies, TV, anything with a story and actors on a screen, really. Join Jason Chan and Robert Snow's free-flowing conversation with deep dives into characters and plot with the occasional salty opinion. So get your popcorn. I got mine right here. Let's start the show!
Welcome to episode 107 of the Extra Buttery Podcast. My name is Robert Snow in Toronto, and I'm joined by my co-host, Jason Chan in Vancouver.
Hi.
This time on the show, we're going to be talking about the darling of film Twitter for the past couple of weeks, Everything Everywhere All at Once by Daniels, the filmmaking duo, followed by the Sonic the Hedgehog sequel, a quiet meditative sci-fi by Koganada called After Yang, and a little bit on Tokyo Vice, a new show starring Ansel Elgort on, what network is it again? Which streamer?
HBO Crave.
Ah, okay. There you go. But I would say, going into Everything Everywhere All at Once, I was very interested to know what you would think about it, because it's exactly the kind of movie that a certain corner of film Twitter has, A, become totally enamored with, but B, it's the kind of movie that I think people on film Twitter have been asking for a long time, namely a action comedy for Asian Americans by an Asian American and a white guy. But just something that, like, you know, has a lot of Asian American representation, telling an immigrant story, but doing so in a way that's kind of like full of comedy, full of crazy, mind-bending, multi-dimensional hijinks.
I'm not your husband. I'm another version of him from another universe. I'm here because we need your help.
Very busy today. No time to help you.
Across the multiverse, I've seen thousands of Evelyns. You can access all of their memories, their emotions, even their skills.
maybe predictably, I liked it a lot, but I'm hearing that maybe you're going against the grain on this one. You have, explain yourself.
Well, you're going to have to convince me why I should like this film.
Oh, okay.
This is one of those movies where I don't get the hype.
Hmm. All right.
Just right off the bat, do you want to just give everyone as concise as you can, I guess, a plot review?
Yeah. Well, so we have Michelle Yeoh in the lead role, and she plays a middle-aged Chinese-American woman who owns a laundromat. Do we know what state she lives in? Is it California?
No, but it actually looks East Coast to me.
Yeah, so it's kind of, they don't really bother identifying it, but it's, you know, maybe a small town somewhere in America. And she's got a long-suffering husband played by Kei Hoi Kwan, who some people will know as Short Round way back in the day in Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom.
Can I just like interject for 1 second? Jonathan Kei Kwan sounds exactly like I thought an adult Short Round would sound like.
Okay.
His voice is the same. It's kind of got like this nasally squeaky quality to it.
Mm.
It hasn't matured at all. The cadence hasn't changed at all either. I thought that was kind of one of the more interesting parts of the film, but anyway.
Oh yeah, that's true. I mean, once you see him, you're like, oh yeah, that is Short Round. Yeah. So Kwan plays Michelle Yeoh's long-suffering husband, and the two of them run this laundromat together. They have a daughter in her early 20s who's kind of resisting some of their overbearing parenting. And by overbearing, I mean like mostly Michelle Yeoh's character, not so much Kwan's character. And they are sort of on the brink of potentially losing their business over some difficult taxes that they're trying to file. And on the surface, it feels like a very kind of normal American story about immigrants trying to operate a small business. But as the story progresses, we see how Michelle Yeoh's character is drawn into this multi-dimensional adventure where she's made aware of all of these concurrent realities that are happening all around her. And she's shown how she can hop between dimensions to access other versions of herself in other universes, tap into their skills, and try to navigate this battle between a all-consuming evil. And it comes out of nowhere, at least for the characters. And it's based on a purely original idea by the filmmakers, Daniel Kwan and Daniel Scheinert. And of course, these are the two filmmakers responsible for Swiss Army Man, which was the Paul Dano, Daniel Radcliffe comedy from a few years back. And I don't know. I mean, this is the kind of movie that is really showing off what they can do on a limited, still relatively limited budget, while still packing the thing with all kinds of crazy visuals, irreverent comedy, just balls to the wall, sci-fi concepts. And I don't know. I mean, it's a little bit rushed. It's a little bit like a lot of sensory overload at times, but it's continually inventive. And I don't know. It's better than a lot of the blockbustery stuff that we've been getting the past few months. So I was definitely on board with it. I thought I had a great time. But you're thinking that it's what, maybe too derivative, or it's,
yeah. So I mean, everyone, including in your own intro, called it original, but I don't see anything original about it. I think the execution was great, though.
Mm, okay.
Like, to your point, for a very, not a very small, but a smaller budget, and considering its scope, it's 2 hours and 20 minutes, I believe,
mm-hmm.
which, by the way, it's half an hour too long.
maybe. I'll allow that.
Yeah. I definitely think so. It goes on too many tangents. I don't see the originality in it in terms of the characters or the plot. I feel like we've seen these multiverse time travel movies a lot. Even the overarching message, especially the overarching message, actually, it really kind of rubbed me the wrong way.
In that there's a kind of a rift between Michelle Yeoh and her daughter, and only by repairing that rift can they achieve a kind of peace or harmony or whatever.
It's a very convoluted way of saying, I love you despite all your faults and weaknesses.
But I mean, isn't that like, is that such a tired formula?
It's not a bad thing, but I just don't think it's original in that sense. As you mentioned, it is very chaotic. I find a movie like this needs a little more structure, especially in terms of its story. it sprawls off in too many directions. And even though I love Short Round, the exposition, the amount he does in this movie is unreal. It is almost difficult to follow sometimes because he has to explain so much. It does kind of feel like empty calories in that the message is simple, but it has a lot of distractions to distract you with. So one of them, and it's not really a distraction, but the acting I found is quite good. But, you know, the whole villainous bagel thing, the whole nihilism thing, I just can't quite get on board with it. The idea that nothing truly matters, which is like kind of the crux of Evelyn's sort of existential crisis that she's going through as like a young 20-something Asian American girl who is gay and has disapproving parents. To me, I feel like I've seen this character a bunch of different times. But like I said, the execution was good because there is really a mishmash of everything. And I don't think I've ever seen a movie with a more apt title.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I would rather there be sort of chaos and maybe some hard to follow portions for the sake of, I don't know, feeling a little bit unhinged and not quite so planned out, you know, because I mean, it's the opposite of a formula. You know, if the one thing that we've been...
Well, but see, that's the thing. It's almost too chaotic. I wish there was a bit more of a structure to it. And I think that would have helped with the runtime, too.
Possibly, yeah, because you're right. You know, they bury you in a lot of the world building, and it can be a little bit difficult to figure out what the rules are and how some of the, like, ability sharing works and things like that. yeah. But, I mean, there's still so much to love about it. Like, the action choreography is legitimately really fun and easy to follow compared to action choreography and a lot of other mainstream stuff, you know?
Well, the one thing I kind of wanted to touch on was that a lot of times I felt I was watching a late night cartoon.
Okay.
Like a lot of the jokes are just off the wall, silly, you know? Like the whole thing about the hot dog thing.
Yes.
Which is from The Office, by the way.
Really?
I believe that was the... Yeah, there's an episode where Dwight references hot dog fingers because there's an episode where they talk about getting health insurance for the whole company. And I think it was either Jim or one of Dwight's friends said that they needed to get coverage that covered hot dog fingers.
Okay.
So that's where I knew that from. So maybe that's a little too like niche because I love The Office.
Although, I mean, this movie is definitely big on just general like tributes and references to other things because you have like this, one of the extended bits in another one of the parallel universes seems to be operating kind of like In the Mood for Love. So like you've got Michelle Yeoh and Kei-Hai Kwan like reprising the central roles from that. You've got this extended bit referencing Ratatouille, except it's got this horrible looking puppet raccoon, which I found hilarious. I thought that was great.
Oh, see, that's where we kind of differ. I found it tiring. I didn't find it that funny. I thought this was like an SNL skit.
I think they held on it just enough. Like it was just weird enough and they didn't dwell on it too long. I think if it had gone on for maybe two or three more minutes, I would have gotten tired of it. But
what about the hot dog fingers?
That
was truly bizarre.
It was incredibly bizarre. I loved the idea of pitching it as like a not only for what it was, but also the jokes about the kind of lesbian romance between Evelyn and Jamie Lee Curtis's character, Deidre. That all of that, very good. The bigger, like more sci-fi-esque stuff was handled pretty well, although that's where it gets like the layers start building up and you can get a little bit kind of exhausted.
I definitely felt exhausted about that part. And like part of it kind of felt like a B movie because even the futuristic technology that some of the characters use, it looks like something that's like from Home Improvement.
Yeah, it's very cobbled together. Yeah.
So there's a bit of that B movie feel. Going back to the action sequence that you're talking about, though, I mean, the part with the butt plugs is just bizarre. I mean, doesn't that feel like, you know, a Duckman? I don't know if you remember. Is it Duckman? It was late night R-rated cartoons on Cartoon Network. And they'd have all these like really adult jokes and like really lewd sexual jokes. And that's what it reminded me of.
I mean, yeah, it's definitely in that, it's in that world. But I mean, where else are you going to get something like that? You know, I'm glad
for this stuff. But I guess part of the charm is getting it without being asked for it. But it was just really bizarre.
Yeah. No, I appreciated the bizarre. I kind of like my sense of humor kind of drifts towards the surreal anyway. So maybe I was already in the movie's camp.
Does it drift towards the crass? Because I grew up in teen comedies like American Pie. And I thought, even for like having watched a movie where a guy like, you know, has sex with a pie. I mean, I thought the butt plug thing was, maybe I'm just getting old, but the butt plug fight scene was just a little too much for me to handle, I think.
But then now you can say out loud the words, the butt plug fight scene. I mean, that's not, that's something that this movie brought into the world.
I guess. I mean, like it does, I think, occupy a very niche part of film genre. But ultimately, I just found it forgettable just because the message underneath was so bland. Like, what did you think of Jobu Tubaki and like the whole evil bagel thing?
That is kind of like layers and layers of multicolored frosting on top of the actual issue at heart, which is the relationship between the mother and the daughter.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think they're dressing it up and making it very kind of nutty and over the top in an interest of kind of like, you know, it's like a spoonful of sugar, you know, you can sit through the like maybe the boring in quotation marks drama stuff as long as it's served to you in this totally wacky format
on an everything bagel.
yeah. So I mean, I was okay with that, but I was also very impressed with Michelle Yeoh's like willingness to not only do things that she's comfortable with, but just like tack on all these extra types of performances that we've never seen her try before.
Agreed.
You know, as the lead of a movie like this, I mean, she has such a long career both in Chinese cinema and also in American films, and she's doing all sorts of kooky stuff here that we've never seen her do before. So that in and of itself was cool.
I think full props to her. I think she was definitely the best part of the film, which kind of brings us to our next topic about Asian American representation. I didn't like it.
I didn't like it.
Partly because it leaned into so many damn stereotypes.
Oh, you found it like excessively representative. Yeah. Okay.
Well, no, not excessively representative. Representative of caricatures and stereotypes and what wider white America thinks of Asians.
And see, that's something that I wouldn't have picked up on because, you know, there were plenty of critics, Asian critics, who were speaking very highly of this because it... you know, having a predominantly Asian cast, I guess that's enough for some people. But if you question
low bar,
yeah, but if you question the, you know, what, how they're actually depicting those characters, then maybe, yeah, it's not quite as cut and dry.
Well, I'll give them props because they all speak different dialects of Chinese languages. And they stuck to that, which is great. They didn't feel like they needed to force him to speak one specific dialect or language. So James Hong speaks Cantonese.
Right.
Michelle Yeoh is Malaysian, I believe.
Okay.
And Jonathan Ke Kwan is from Vietnam, I think. So you could actually, like, if your ear is trained to it and you know the language, you know that they're all speaking different languages. So James Hong and Michelle Yeoh will speak in Cantonese sometimes.
Right.
And then, but Michelle Yeoh and Jonathan Ke Kwan will speak in Mandarin, but it's Mandarin with like a Malaysian Singaporean tinge to it.
Okay.
So I'm glad that they kept that and actually kind of wrote it into the movie. But like the whole disapproving grandfather because the granddaughter's gay, the meek husband, the wife who regrets the immigration, the wife who's in an unhappy marriage. I mean, I guess props to them for, I guess, portraying it rather accurately, but I found very little interest in it. Do you remember that Awkwafina movie? What was it called?
The Farewell.
The Farewell. I thought that was a better representation of the gulf between, say, Gen X, millennial, American, Asian Americans versus Asian immigrant parents.
But isn't that like, isn't there like a higher burden of, I guess, expectation on The Farewell because it's a straight up drama slash comedy as opposed to, you know, this where it's like almost, I mean, I'm not saying that that stereotypes are okay, but sometimes you have to work with stock characters if you're inserting them into like a crazy genre.
Yeah, like this movie. And again, this is where like the lack of the originality, in my opinion, kind of confused me, because everyone says this was really original, and I guess the execution was, but
yeah, that's sort of what I mean too. It's like it's not so much original in the sense that the individual bits and pieces are inventive, it's how they're put together, and it's the remixing of it, where it's like, okay, have you ever seen a movie that takes references from In the Mood for Love and Ratatouille and Guardians of the Galaxy and The Matrix and puts them all together in one soup?
Yeah, you so know?
That's the inventiveness I think that people are talking
fair
about.
Enough. I mean I dislike Matrix 4 for the same reasons, right? So you can be meta, but I wish it was more clever than that. The whole multiverse thing, I feel like Marvel and Spider-Man have ruined any multiverse movie trope for me ever. It's just too much, you know, like it's almost too easy to explain things. Just saying like, oh, there's an alternate universe where I did this, so I know that skill or have that trait in this universe too.
Right.
And just makes it too easy to translate between the two worlds.
Hey, it's definitely, multiverse is definitely having a moment in the sun right now. I mean, it's kind of in the way that like time travel did maybe back around the time that Endgame came out. Yeah. There was a lot of time travel stuff. Multiverse is kind of like time travel, but with, you know, certain subtle differences.
Yeah. It's always a dicey concept though, right? Like you think too much about time travel, it kind of stops making sense after a while. Even like one of my favorite time travel movies, Looper.
Yeah.
Which I know you like too.
Yeah.
Like even if you think about it a little too much, like it just kind of stops making sense. Yeah. But you still want it to make sense for the sake of enjoying
exactly,
the movie.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Like the actual mechanism in this of being able to borrow the skills across universes, like barring some sort of another bit of info dump where they talk about like quantum entanglement or something like that. The actual way that it works is very opaque.
Yeah. Even when Waymond was trying to explain the whole thing, I was kind of just like, can we just skip this part, please?
Yeah. Yeah,
I really don't care how it works. I just need to know it works. And it's kind of like the MacGuffin part of the movie too, right? Where like they're just like, okay, something bad is coming or happening. You just accept it.
And that is where like as the movie continues, like after we've seen the roughly how that process works, it's almost like there are certain moments where they kind of skim over the technicalities and they're like, all right, she has this ability now. Like just run with it.
Yes.
And you don't necessarily see where it might have come from and or how that plays in it. Yeah, so it's easy to get lost. I'll give you that.
Yeah, unfortunately not on my top list.
But would this be a movie that you would still like, despite your own personal feelings about it, would you recommend it to somebody who is like, hey, I want something to go see at the movies that's not a big franchise thing? Would you recommend it as that to like somebody who didn't know anything about the people involved or anything, like just as a, like a fun time at the movies? Or would you recommend something completely different?
Depends on the person. I think someone more well-versed in film and filmmaking would appreciate this more than the layperson.
Right.
I think the layperson goes into the movies looking for something pretty straightforward.
Yeah, that's valid. Yeah. I mean, there's a reason why Marvel has done as well as it has.
Yeah. And I think Marvel also has the advantage in that it's already baked in so much into like a cultural fabric. Like, you don't need to see the Avengers to know who Robert Downey Jr. plays in the movie.
Right.
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 And so this film is definitely more niche. I would recommend it to someone like you, but I mean, to my parents, no. Even though they've seen Michelle Yeoh movies their entire lives, no. This would just be way too overwhelming and way too confusing and probably not very interesting to them.
Hmm. All right. Well, I've already tried recommending it to a few people who may not necessarily be film nerds. So when they do see it.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That would be a fun exercise.
Get that data, you know? All right. Well, so we're still talking about mostly new stuff in this episode. So tell me a little bit about Sonic the Hedgehog 2. This is not something that I would have.
Deep sigh.
Deep sigh. This is not a film that I would have thought we'd actually get in the run-up to the first movie coming out, because There was a lot of stuff on the internet about how terrible this was going to be, and then it turned out to not be terrible. And so here we are a couple of years later with the sequel that nobody thought we would really get.
It's a huge hit, both of them. Financial hits. First and foremost, they're kids' movies. I don't think there's any denying that.
Yes. These are not family movies in the sense of, like, jokes for adults in the same way as, like,
some
here and there, but not the concentration that you might expect from, say, a Pixar film or...
Well, see, I have always felt that Pixar was always mislabeled as children's features. They're not. I think they're adult features just with cute animation.
Yeah, there's an argument there. Yeah.
Yeah, I think the themes that Pixar deals with are a lot deeper than Sonic. Sonic is just good guy defeats bad guy.
Yeah.
Anyway, Sonic the Hedgehog 2.
Stand still and die!
For a guy named Knuckles, you are really bad at punching.
We kind of begin where we left off with the first one. Dr. Robotnik has been banished to this planet that's filled with, you know, special mushrooms, for lack of a better word.
Yeah.
And he somehow escapes. Comes back to Earth, and he bumps into this new character called Knuckles, which is the red one you see. Knuckles is this fearsome warrior from this faraway tribe, and he's the last of his kind, blah, blah, blah. Anyway.
Is he from the same planet as Sonic?
Who knows? Who cares?
Okay.
but Sonic is the blue one, Knuckles is the red one, and then we're also introduced to Tails, which is the orange one that looks like a fox and has two tails.
Right.
Sonic and Tails have always been kind of like buddies, like Batman and Robin in the video game, so that's where it comes from. But anyway, all parties involved are looking for this green emerald that's supposed to give you massive power. Power in what sense, I have no idea. But they're all looking for this big emerald jewel anyway.
Right.
So, I mean, just based on that, I mean, the plot is pretty, like, threadbare. There's very little connective tissue connecting everything, in my opinion. And honestly, as much as I enjoyed the first one, surprisingly, it's a decent video game film. This one was definitely not as good as the first one. Visually, I mean, the CGI is great, but I found all movie that the most interesting visual things to me were pointing out the streets that they filmed it in, because it's filmed in Vancouver, and I could tell you exactly which block they filmed it on.
Yeah.
Even though the film goes through great lengths to tell you that it's set in Seattle.
Yes.
Which is, again, like one of those things where, like, Vancouver never plays itself.
Yes.
For whatever reason.
Thank you. Thank you, Tony Joe, for that video essay a number of years ago. Yeah. Very, very well put.
Yeah, and so, I mean, the big draw for this film is the introduction of Knuckles, who has always been a very popular character. But, I mean, he does the same thing as any anti-hero would do in any film. He makes the mistake of teaming up with Dr. Robotnik, realizes that he somehow made a mistake, and then teams with the Sonic to defeat Dr. Robotnik.
Yep.
Ta-da! That's the film.
Yeah.
And I think the crux of the first one is we got to see Sonic as, like, a living, breathing character who is very funny and does go through, like, somewhat of a personal journey. He matures throughout the film. We don't see that at all in this film. I think he's very stock. He hasn't grown from the last scene of the first movie till the end of this movie. It's very much one of those things where, like, let's throw character development out the window and let's come up with a bunch of, like, crazy CGI and a bunch of sets that'll look interesting on screen. Plot, character-wise, both failures, in my opinion, which is why it's not very interesting. James Marsden plays the human character that we're all supposed to identify with. But again, he's also not very interesting because he's the white male lead that even his own movies don't care about, because he gets killed off or his girlfriend runs away with someone else in every single film he's in. Except for this one, I guess. But my one final gripe is, wow, I have a lot of gripes, so yeah, that's unfair. Sorry. Idris Elba. So animated films these days have done sort of like, I don't want to say hack job, but they've made a point of casting well-known actors in voice acting roles to sell you a movie ticket.
Yep.
So Knuckles is voiced by Idris Elba in this one. Idris Elba is so poorly cast. I had to, like, smack my head a couple times while watching it. So we all know Idris Elba. He's like this really tall, good-looking black dude, and he plays a hero or anti-hero in a lot of his films, right? He is not known to be comedic acting. I don't think there's a funny bone in his body. Even when he was in The Office, he was funny because he played the most serious character in a show about goofballs.
Right.
And like, he always was aware that he was smarter than everyone else, and that's what kind of made him funny. As Knuckles, he's like this fish out of water tough guy, and it doesn't work because Knuckles comes off as very, very stupid. Like, he just doesn't catch on with whatever else is going on. And I think it's one thing to be, you know, in a dry humor sort of scene, to be the smart guy, the straight guy, versus the straight guy, but who's also kind of dumb because he doesn't know anything.
When you were pointing out how Knuckles, the extent of Knuckles' character is just like, oh, he starts out as evil, doesn't like Sonic, has a change of heart, teams up against Robotnik. I mean, not only is that a very stock character arc, but there's not a lot for Idris Elba to do with that, you know?
True. I guess not all of it is on him. The script is pretty weak. The story itself is weak, and that's maybe the cause of it, but I don't understand all the positive reviews it's getting. Visually, is it interesting? Maybe. I mean, watching Jim Carrey do his thing, I guess, is kind of interesting, but...
Yeah, I was just about to ask, like, is he doing... Because one of the things that kind of distinguished the first Sonic movie was that we got a return of Jim Carrey back to the kind of energy level that he was at in the 90s. It had been a while since we saw him doing the zany stuff that, you know, his trademark gestures and expressions and everything that people loved about the characters he played in the 90s. And he had gone off and done all sorts of other work in between that, you know, I guess was meaningful to him at the time. But yeah, it was cool to see him back in zany mode. So is he doing that again here? Is it basically the same performance as the first one, or?
It is, but you know how it took like the entire decade of the 90s for people to get tired of Jim Carrey? It takes about 10 minutes in this movie.
He's okay.
So he's doing the same thing. It's just, it's a little much. His punny lines are not funny at all. I didn't care for it, to be honest. Maybe because his shtick is just that tiring. I didn't really find it all that amusing. I think actually for a few stretches in the movie, I probably kind of just dozed off. Like, there are gaps in my memory when I'm thinking about this movie where I, like, where it's like, did I miss a scene or did just this film not make sense at all? Because there's a subplot about James Marsden's wife's sister getting married and how her husband doesn't like James Marsden.
That sounds like a total distraction from the rest of the movie.
Yeah. And there's a wedding in Hawaii that gets ruined, and I don't even know why it's set in Hawaii, other than maybe because the cast and crew want a vacation to Hawaii. Because you could have set this entire film in Vancouver, and it would have been just fine. And some like alternate universe where they go, I don't even remember for sure. But yeah, I think if you liked the first one, maybe you can give this one a shot. But it's definitely inferior to the first film. Definitely, definitely. Inferior.
No, I mean, I remember coming out of the first one and thinking to myself, yeah, I can see how this will get a sequel. I can see how it will find an audience, despite all of the...
But it wasn't that bad, right?
It wasn't bad. I mean, there were enjoyable things about it for the right people, yeah. For the people who were looking for something like that, especially people who were fans of the Sonic games and were familiar with the mm-hmm. characters and wanted to see them done well on the big screen. So all of that mm-hmm. is fine. It's not the movie for me, but... mm-hmm. Yeah, and I wasn't rushing out to see this thing. So whatever. I mean, yeah, I'm fine with the with this little franchise continuing along. If it makes more money, gets a third one, all the better. I will only be interested again if they find a way to sync this up with the Chris Pratt Mario movie.
Well, would they ever? Mario's Nintendo.
Mario and Sonic have been in games together. So.
Have they? I didn't know that.
Yeah. Because they work it out as like a license sharing thing between, I guess, Sega, whoever owns Sega right now, which who, you know, they did Sonic and Nintendo, and they've done games like Mario and Sonic at the Olympic Games, and and like Sonic has been in Smash Bros and stuff like that. So,
oh, that's true, Smash Brothers. That's right.
So yeah, they license the characters back and forth depending on what suits them, and
there will be a third film. I'm pretty positive of that. 200 million gross worldwide already.
We have to have the cinematic universe then.
Enough with the cinematic universes. Jesus, give it a break. Oh my God.
But what would be more appropriate for a Sonic the Hedgehog 3 than to have a really bad Mario in
it? Well, I mean, I'm still waiting.
Because you know Chris Pratt's Mario is going to be bad.
Yeah, you're probably right. But I'm still waiting for fat Dr. Robotnik, not skinny Dr. Robotnik. So maybe that'll be the third one. Yeah. That'll be his character arc.
But fat Dr. Robotnik is not in keeping with like the modern age obsession with health and fitness, you know?
Whatever, man. It'll be a nice character, you know, plot point about how he like has failed to kill Sonic so many times he eats himself into obesity. how about that for a character arc? Falls into depression. Turns over a new leaf, or maybe he gets a renewed energy and hatches some other half-baked plan to take out Sonic. Hell, why not just introduce Mega Man while we're at it, huh?
don't give them any ideas. They probably are probably working that out.
Clearly they need some. Yeah. All right, on to better things, because I'm sure Coconata's After Yang is way better than both of them.
Yes, and I'm very curious to know if you end up watching this when it's on streaming. I think it may be in streaming eventually. This one didn't play in like bigger theaters at all. It opened here at TIFF, so it was definitely,
okay.
You know, it's an art house movie for sure.
Everything Coconata does is art house.
Yes.
Man. There's not a commercial bone in his body.
So Coconata, for the folks who aren't familiar, he made a film back in 2017 called Columbus that I was totally in love with.
Yes, you were.
And partially because it has a score by Hammock, a band I like, partially because it's it tells a story that I identify with, you know, growing up in a small town and wondering whether or not to move away for the sake of one's career. And it was just very quiet and meditative and just exquisitely performed. Like, you know,
Hold on. Is St. John's a small town? It's not.
By comparison with most other places in the world, sure. 150,000 people.
Well, I guess. But I mean, that means every city in Canada is small except for Toronto. Even Toronto isn't that big then. Like, when you say small town, I always think of like, you know, Anagonish, you know?
Okay, well, I mean, I do have the other smaller town, Bonafides, too. I mean, I was born in a place with like 5,000 people. So is that small enough?
Wait, where?
And it's a town called Catalina.
I did not know this. Where the hell is Catalina?
Well, you can look it up. You can Google Maps it. It's worth proving, you know, I might have been raised in St. John's, but born in an even smaller place. So, I mean, I know where Coconata is coming from in this.
Okay.
But anyway, that I loved Columbus, and it took 5 years for his next film to come out, but now we have it, After Yang.
What happened to Yang?
I don't know. He shut down last night. He won't restart.
Has this happened before?
No.
If we can't get Yang fixed, we're not gonna buy another sibling for Mika.
After Yang is it's a sci-fi film, but not in a overbearing way at all. There's not a lot of like oppressive world building, or it's a story that could equally work in the here and now.
Mm-hmm.
It just happens to be set in some fairly far future scenario. And in this world, we've got Colin Farrell playing a tea master. He has a little tea shop, and he's married to a woman played by Jodie Smith-Turner, and together they have adopted a daughter who happens to be Chinese. And they're concerned that their daughter will grow up to not know enough about her Chinese heritage. So they pool some funds together, they save up, and they buy what's called a second sibling, which in their world is a totally lifelike android who is synthetic. They're called a technosapien in the world of the film. And this technosapien named Yang is intended to be an older brother for their daughter. And he himself is Chinese, or he's made to look like he's Chinese, and he's been loaded up with all sorts of Chinese fun facts, as the characters are always saying, about Chinese history, Chinese culture, and he forms a very strong bond with the daughter, and they become, like, you know, for all intents and purposes, siblings. And then one day, just as the events of the film begin, Yang shuts down. He doesn't turn back on again. And so then the family has to grapple with, okay, can we find a way to repair him? Can we get him to turn back on? And through going through this process, they discover that it's highly unlikely, and they're going to have to come to grips with losing this member of their family who happened to be synthetic. And they start accessing the memory banks in his head, and they discover that he's not, his story wasn't quite as simple as they were led to believe when they purchased him. He had other families that he had been assigned to over the years. And the story just kind of spools out from there. It's not particularly long. It's the movie's only about an hour, 40 minutes, but it just explores the nature of memory and humanity. And it works equally well as just the story of a family losing a child or a sibling losing an older sibling, you know? And I just got totally lost in this thing. Like, it's everything about the sound design and the sets and the costumes, you know, it's a version of the future that you kind of want to live in, where the houses are exquisitely designed and everyone drives around in autonomous cars that also have like planter boxes inside them where plants are growing for no good reason other than that they look nice and they provide a nice ambiance. And yeah, you spend this hour and 40 minutes with these characters and then you move on. And it's just all very, you know, airy and meditative, just like kind of like Columbus in that way. And I was like, yeah, give me more of this. I love this.
Well, I was just going to say, just from the way you described it, sounds like a Coconata thing where everything is like visually immaculate.
Yes. Yeah. Like I want to live in the house that these characters live in. I want to, all the clothes are like loose and airy. Like they're just, they're kind of like subtly Asian inspired, but still their own thing.
50 years from now, you're going to live in some like remote Californian community where this is real life.
Yeah.
It's not so much like the design or the way he does things, but the way he frames things is always really interesting to me. Like everything is perfectly framed. Yes.
Yeah.
You know, everything has meaning. I don't know if I would love to live in the world he does. It seems a little too stiff and dry.
Maybe.
And boring, but I totally get what you mean. So, but explain to me like how this sort of like tragedy kind of unfolds, because Columbus was a very quiet story. This feels a lot more dramatic.
It's dramatic in the sense that like a character is suddenly lost to the other characters, but it's treated as if, you know, Yang had been sick with something and then he died. You know, that's about how simple it is. And so at first they think, oh, maybe we can get him back because he is a technical creation. You know, there's got to be some way we can kind of bypass the security features in his core and get him back online. But then they discover, nah, he's totally done. Like the most we can do is extract his memories and kind of relive our lives through his eyes, which leads to kind of this really nice moment when Colin Farrell is wearing these like VR glasses that look like really stylish sunglasses. And his daughter breaks him out of his reverie because he's been rewatching Yang's point of view on various moments through his life. And the daughter says, oh, what are you watching? A documentary? And Colin Farrell's character says, yeah, I basically am. You know, it's a documentary that he didn't know that Yang was recording about his life.
So one of the things about Columbus is that some people think it's very flat in that there's not very high or low moments, like everything's pretty well contained.
Yes.
Do you find it in this one as well? Like, do characters ever speak in volumes other than just normal speaking volume?
No, they don't. There's very, very little shouting. And I mean, I can see how people could maybe get bored by that or want a little bit more drama or whatever from the movie. But I don't know. You set this movie against other ones that you might watch in a given month or a given week that might be louder and more dynamic and have more in your face type stuff. And then for me, I treat Coconata's movies kind of like a palate cleanser where it's like, all right, I can have a moment where people aren't getting up in each other's faces and screaming and firing guns and stuff like that. I can have this kind of like this relaxation point. And so, yeah, it's in the moment, not a lot is happening, but then you kind of come out of it and you're like, oh, that was nice.
Do you know that, what's that genre of music that people listen to on YouTube? It's like soft jazz or something.
Oh yeah, like lo-fi.
Lo-fi, yeah. So yeah. Coconata's movies are like lo-fi.
Yes, yeah.
To me.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes the edges are crispier and the a little bit more cleaned up than maybe a lo-fi recording would be. But yeah, the same basic idea where it's just like, it's not something that you are gripping the edge of your seat watching. You're just kind of bathing in it. You know,
fair enough. Did they ever say what place or city this was set in?
I think it seems to be set somewhere in California. I think maybe San Francisco, but it's a vastly different skyline. Like there are big like geodesic domes that people live in, and there's really flashy looking futuristic towers on the horizon. So it's definitely, and you don't see very much of the city beyond just a couple of establishing shots, and that's about it. Like the rest of it happens in the main family home or in the self-driving cars that are ferrying them around, that kind of thing.
I'll definitely want to watch this at some point. I didn't enjoy Columbus as much as you did, but I thought it was very good. And I'll watch anything with Colin Farrell, and I'll watch anything with Haley Lou Richardson, and Coconut is a really great visual director, so.
Yeah, exactly. If you, once you're in the mood for it and you know what to expect from having watched Columbus, that's basically what you're getting again, just a different context, a different set of characters. Like I was saying, it's just something they put on and just sort of...
I feel like that's the same with Everything Everywhere All at Once, where like you really have to be in a mood where you're kind of open and receptive to these things.
Yes. Yep.
So I feel like maybe that goes for all movies, you know?
Yeah, you can get a lot more out of a movie if you just happen to be in the right headspace for what it's dishing out, you know?
100% agreed. Yeah.
All right. Well, then to close out the episode, then, do you want to tell me about Tokyo Vice?
Jake, this is Sato. He's not as brooding as he seems.
What's it like to be a Yakuza? I could write about that.
Yes. But then I'd have to kill you.
Because I think you should watch this.
All I know about this is that it's like a Japan set gangster story.
Yeah, somewhat. Yeah.
Ken Watanabe is in it. So is Ansel Elgort. I believe he's the star. It has a premiere episode directed by Michael Mann, who I know you're a big fan of.
Yeah.
And that's about all I know. I saw a few people on film Twitter like discussing whether or not it was worth anyone's time because like Michael Mann's only doing the first episode and it's just other directors afterwards. So maybe there were a few people arguing that like, well, Michael Mann's not really involved. And so it's not, you know, for Mann fanatics, it's not really worth their time.
Okay. I mean, that's a fair point because it's obviously not directed by Mann, the other episodes, I mean. But the first episode, the pilot, is always very important because he sets the tone for the rest of the series. And so the rest of the series does follow in tone.
Right.
I do think you can feel that it's not really a Michael Mann directed episode. But I mean, it's the same with Game of Thrones. You know, like you had a bunch of different directors, but the tone, maybe except for season 8, was pretty consistent throughout.
Right.
And I mean, you're so wrapped up in the characters and the plot that you're not really paying attention to these, you know, director trademarks or whatever, and you're not really actively looking for them.
Yeah, that's fair.
But Tokyo Vice, based on a book by Jake Adelstein. Jake Adelstein is an American journalist from Missouri who moves to Japan and becomes the first foreign-born reporter for one of Japan's biggest newspapers. The one he works for in the TV show, I believe, is fictional.
Ah.
So the TV show is based on his book, but it's very loosely based. It follows the general gist of it. So anyway, main crux of the story is Jake gets hired by these Japanese newspapers and he quickly has a knack for making connections on the crime beat. And because he's a foreigner, or a gaijin, as they say, he finds he has potentially fewer roadblocks in the sense that he's not really afraid of the Yakuza. most local people don't question or don't ask questions about the Yakuza because for them, it means death. They know they're there, but if they don't bother the Yakuza, then there's no bother in their lives. For Jake, it is a beat that he's passionate about. It's a story that he believes that should be told. So he starts making friends with Yakuza. Ken Watanabe plays the police detective who's sort of an arbiter between the police and the Yakuza. He's obviously a cop, but he's been on the beat so long, he knows the ins and outs of the Yakuza and he knows how to handle them. And so the story is about him being a mentor to Jake and Jake, you know, uncovering all this criminal underworld that no one really talks about.
Right.
So in real life, the real Jake Adelstein kind of interestingly had to leave Japan because he wrote a piece about the Yakuza. So the story was about this Yakuza crime boss who needed an organ transplant. And in exchange for having the organ transplant done in the US, the Yakuza boss would give up information to the FBI about how the Yakuza conducts business. After the Yakuza boss got the organ transplant, he basically didn't give any information to the authorities. And so Jake Adelstein wrote a story about this, about how the Yakuza crime boss had used American, you know, doctors and funds and expertise in getting this organ transplant, and the government had paid for it, and the US government essentially got duped. And so the Yakuza obviously weren't happy, so the real Jake Adelstein had to move back to the US. You can get his book. I have his book. It's not a bad read, but I think the show was more interesting just from a visual standpoint. Like all Michael Mann movies, it does blur the line between good and evil very well. Because as a reporter, as people know, you do have to talk and make friends and make connections with people who, you know, aren't morally righteous all the time.
Yeah.
And so we're only six episodes in. There's two more yet to be released, but I highly recommend it because it is a crime drama, a bit of a procedural, and I think they really do portray things about the Japanese culture and Yakuza culture that we don't get to see very often in film. Mm. Ansel Elgort plays Jake. He is by far the most boring character because he's honestly, like, it's not really his fault because he's the white dude in an Asian world where he's just taking everything in.
Right.
So he's kind of like our eyes and ears. So he can't have too many personality quirks because a lot of information has to be transferred to him and then to us.
Right.
The side characters, I mean, the foreign expat girls who work in these hostess bars, his young Yakuza friend who's climbing up the ranks in the Yakuza, his mentors, both at the newspaper, played by Rinko Kikuchi, who played the woman, the female lead in Pacific Rim and a whole bunch of other films, and Babel. And then Ken Watanabe as his police mentor. I think all these characters are really what drives the show, and they all have their own little subplots that are really, really interesting. It is not loud or violent by any means, except for one episode in episode six, where rival Yakuza gangs start this war on each other's turf. It's a very interesting watch. Every episode is like 45 minutes to an hour, pretty standard, but I highly, highly recommend it.
I first started seeing people talking about it, and I was seeing like bits of the marketing and the poster and things like that. Mm-hmm. I erroneously assumed that it was basically another version of, I think it was like a Netflix original that came out a couple of years ago, where Jared Leto plays a white guy who's invited to become like the first white member of the Yakuza, and he's given a ninja sword and stuff like that.
That is the dumbest thing I've ever heard.
It's a real movie that exists, and it came out on Netflix like maybe 2 or 3 years ago.
So, like, Tom Cruise had the same sort of controversy, when he played The Last Samurai?
Yeah, except that was based on history, wasn't it? Like he was playing a real American military consultant who...
Right, but the controversy was that it was implied that the last samurai in history was white.
Oh, I see. Yeah, I can see how that would be.
And that he had been somehow accepted into like samurai culture and like the feudal system and the shogunates and whatnot.
Right. So, okay. So then this movie was called The Outsider. And
S.E. Hinton is rolling around in her grave right now.
And so the log line on IMDb is literally an epic set in post-World War II Japan and centered on an American former GI who joins the Yakuza.
That sounds stupid. And I hope Jared Leto didn't go through his method acting and try to be Asian like Sean Connery and James Bond.
Well, you know that he did.
Okay. Oh, that's another thing. Ansel Elgort's Japanese in this TV show is pretty good.
Oh, okay. So he got like a proper dialect coach and stuff.
Yeah. I mean, you can still hear the accent, but it's quite good. The real Jake Adelstein obviously spoke and wrote fluent Japanese. Anytime they have these like crime movies, they always try to play it up as like this big action dramatic feature.
Yes.
But really, I think some of the best crime films are the ones that are like super quiet, where violence is used to better effect when it's very minimal.
Yes, I agree. Yeah.
So this is the one where I was really like you, kind of waiting for like the big shootout, you know, the big fight, and it never really comes. And I'm really happy it never does.
Yeah, because that just enhances the tension because you don't know what's around
exactly.
the corner. Yeah,
exactly.
That's good. All right. Well, Tokyo Vice, I will I'll have to make some time for that then, because yes. I am getting to the end of Station 11, which is also on HBO Max. That's a Max original. But that one is because it's set in the after. In the years after a pandemic, it's considering the pandemic is still sort of going on, it can be a little bit of a rough watch because you're being presented with imagery that feels a little bit too close to home. So yeah, maybe Tokyo Vice will be a bit of a palate cleanser after that.
Yeah, it's from the way you describe it, it sounds like it's a very different show.
Yeah, well, it's supposed to be more optimistic though, because it's 20 years after a global pandemic that was like 100 times more deadly. So there's very few humans left and they're trying to rebuild society. And it's got like aspects of Lost and a couple of other shows in there that I appreciated. And it was like some Fallout game series stuff, just general post-apocalyptic stuff. So
why have we never really gotten a movie about the post-Black Plague?
Yeah.
I can't think of a single movie that takes place during that time. Can you?
No. It's always like a briefer segment in some other like thing about like historical time travel or something. Yeah. I don't know why. That would
be like an interesting topic, you know? Like,
I did read a book that was kind of set partially in the Black Plague, and that was kind of harrowing. Lots of people just like coughing up pus and stuff like that. It was a bit of a slog.
Yeah, considering all like the medieval movies and you know stuff that we get from that era, none of them, I can't recall a single film that really dealt with it head on. Like, we're getting all these like pandemic era films, right?
Yeah, but they're like sometimes they're like comedies of like, oh, we're locked down together, what do we do?
Yeah, whereas the Black Plague was like the most deadliest thing ever. Maybe one day we'll write one. Everyone dies, the end.
we'll let a decade or so elapse so that, you know, the bad vibes are kind of in the rear view.
Yeah, it's true.
Cool. All right, well, so then basically that leaves us with a split decision on Everything Everywhere All at Once.
Oh, okay, well, hold on. I didn't like it that much, but it's not a bad film by any means, I think.
Okay, all right, so a little bit more shades of gray then. A do not recommend on Sonic the Hedgehog 2.
No.
Hearty recommendation for me on After Yang, and hearty recommendation on Tokyo Vice. So, I mean, that's pushing us more towards the positive end.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. We're always positive here, right?
And so then coming up on the show, there are still lots of interesting things coming out. I myself am very excited for The Northman from Robert Eggers.
I'm watching that this weekend.
Oh, excellent. And I'm probably watching The Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent, the Nick Cage meta comedy that's also coming out this weekend.
I'll try and catch that one.
So hopefully we will have some discussion on both of those movies in the next episode.
We got a bunch of blockbusters coming up.
Yeah, as we get into summer movie season with May, like, we're going to finally see Top Gun Maverick, I think.
Yes.
So that is a big one on the nearer horizon.
Doctor Strange 2 is coming out in 2 weeks.
Yeah, we may fit Doctor Strange 2 into the next episode because the timing might work out on that. But so yeah, come on back for discussion of those movies. And until that next episode, my name is Robert Snow in Toronto.
And my name is Jason Chen in Vancouver. Thank you for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.
The Extra Buttery Podcast is written, recorded, and produced by Jason Chen and Robert Snow. Thank you for listening, and don't forget to rate and subscribe on the podcast platform of your choice. And remember, popcorn is always better with extra butter.